tonight, something very important happens, and I hope that it happens at my house. I've put up signs for the Publishers Clearinghouse folks to be able to find our place, and that's real important. This week in our staff meeting, the pastoral staff spent time trying to decide what it is that we need to cut from our budgets and tweak our own budgets down to an acceptable amount for the annual business meeting. After that was over, we were talking about some things that we would really like to have. For instance, this beautiful organ over here that is on loan from a local music company, and a wonderful sign like Messiah Lutheran Church has down by Baptist Hospital. I love that sign. If that sign ever shows up missing, you know that I've stolen it for us. You know, you do something for God. There are some things that we have on our wish list. And, you know, I relate to Peter. You know, I speak often before I think about what I'm going to say. And I said to Randy, you know, if I win the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes this weekend, I'll get all that stuff for the church. And Randy said, now we have heard you. You have spoken in and amongst witnesses. So if that happens, we're going to hold you to your word. And I thought, you know, what's a couple of hundred grand in light of a, you know, a million for a lifetime? You know, I can handle that. But I say that to help you, to invite you to think about something this morning. What is the purpose of our giving? What do we give for? Does God need our money? Is He in heaven saying, boy, I hope those folks at Metropolitan give, because if they don't, we're going to have to lay off some of our angels. We're going to have to sell a couple of the golden gates. Instead of having 12 gates in heaven, we're only going to have 10 because we just don't have the money to run the joint. That's not how heaven works. God does not need our money. And if God doesn't need our money, then why do we give? Well, I hope by the end of our time this morning, I will make that clear to you why we give. If you don't have a Bible, we have some pew Bibles, and if you'll turn to page 423, that's the 50th Psalm, that's the Psalm we're going to be looking at. And I'm going to be reading out of the New International Version, and I've chosen this not because it suits my needs, but because I feel like it clearly interprets the Psalm in a way that it makes sense to us. So if you'll turn there, why do we give? The scene in Psalm 50 is a courtroom. Now, I can't speak from experience, but a courtroom, I would imagine, is a serious place. I'm not a lawyer, and I haven't been on the wrong side of the law, so I don't know a whole lot about court proceedings. But what I've seen from television programs, it always looks like kind of a serious place. And the scene here is a courtroom. And the picture we see is of a self-sufficient, omnipotent, sovereign God who needs nothing. And this is a God who, first of all, doesn't need our gifts. And He certainly doesn't want the gifts of pagans. And so, I've asked this question twice already in 2 minutes. I'm going to ask again, why do we give? Does God need our gifts? Well, before I read the text, I want to kind of lead you down a pathway, a syllogism. I'm going to build an argument. God made us. He knows us better than any therapist. He knows us better than our pastor knows us, or our wife, or even our mama. He knows us better than anybody. And if this is true, then He knows what makes us healthy. And if He knows what makes us healthy, apparently He knows that we have this deep need to give back to Him part of what He has given to us. And apparently it needs to be sacrificially. It needs to be from the heart, but it also needs to be in a form that it makes an impact on us. You know, if they bring me my couple of million dollars tonight in that van, you know, I'm thinking, how are they going to get all that money to my house? When they bring that money, you know, if I gave that all away, which would be nice, you know, there's not a whole lot gained, so there's not a whole lot lost. It's not like I feel it. It's kind of like when you never use cash and you just write checks, you know, you never see the money. It comes in the form of paper and it leaves, and you never really see any of it. And there's no impact. Now, God made us, and somehow when He made us, He knew that He made us with this need to give. Give out of thanksgiving. Give out of gratitude. And so part of what makes us healthy as people is giving back to Him. Now, don't think I'm teaching prosperity theology. That's not the point that I want to make this morning. But when we engage in this act of giving back to God sacrificially part of what He's given us, it's like it opens the door. And we see through the door and we see that's what God did when He gave His Son on the cross for me. Now I understand a little bit better. Something in the act of sacrificial giving prepares my heart to understand what it meant when John said, "For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son." It gives new meaning to the word giving of myself, giving sacrificially. So look at Psalm 50, please. The first thing I want to point out to you this morning about this is the righteous judgment of God. The judge appears. Verse 1, the mighty one, God, the Lord, speaks and summons the earth from the rising of the sun to the place where it sets. Folks, make no mistake about it. This is the one true God. In this first verse, three of the different names of God are presented. El, which means God or the one God. Elohim, which means the God creator. That's in the beginning, God, plural, created the heavens and the earth. And thirdly, Yahweh, God Redeemer. The only God, God creator, and God Redeemer. This God, the one true God, is saying, I'm sending out a summons. And I can't imagine the shock. You know, I've seen this in the movies where some guy's out minding his own business and some anonymous person walks up to him and says, "Are you Joe Smith?" And the guy says, "Yeah," and hands him that summons that you're invited to appear in court. And that's what's happening here. A summons has been sent out by the one true God. And in verse 2 it says, "From Zion, perfect in beauty, God shines forth." When I was about 4 years old, we went on a train trip to Wichita, Kansas. Or Arkansas City, Kansas. And we got to the train station about 4 o'clock in the morning. And there was no train there. But I remember off in the distance, in the dark, seeing the light. The train lights used to sweep back and forth. They didn't just shine straight ahead. They would sweep back and forth. And as that train began to approach from a distance, the rumbling was soft, but as it got near, the ground began to shake, and that light was sweeping back and forth. And when the train roared into the station, this little 4-year-old guy was amazed by it. You know, this picture of God shining forth is a God who is embodied. The metaphor for God is light. And John said that in Him, that the book, the epistle of John talks about how God is light. And if we walk in the light, and it uses this metaphor of darkness and light. And the picture here is of a God who is exposing sin, a God who is shining the light on sin. My wife always is horrified when I tell this illustration, and I've told it to the singles about 3 times, and I've probably told it to you more than once. But when I was in college, I lived in an apartment, and you know, college guys are really not all that great on cooking, and they're not great at all about cleaning, you know. And I'd come in from a date and I'd flip on the light in my apartment and the roaches would just scatter. It's kind of gross, huh? But they didn't like being exposed to the light. God is coming. He's convening His court session, and He is light. And as He approaches, the sinfulness of man is exposed. Verse 3, our God comes and will not be silent. A fire devours before Him, and around Him a tempest rages. Think of this picture. God is coming. And it's like in front of him, there's fire and it's burning up the road. You know, it's charring the earth, and a whirlwind goes around him. And when my boys were little, they'd watch cartoons, and there was a character called Taz, and he was the Tasmanian devil. And you never saw him, you just saw this tornado that was tearing up ground as Taz approached. Well, you know, I know that's kind of a simplistic illustration, but the picture here is of a God who is so powerful that the earth is scorched before him and things are stirred up, and there's no way you can sleep through his approach. If you're off in your own little world doing your own little thing, I promise you that when he approaches, he'll wake you up. And so God is convening court, and there's no mistake that it is the one true God, and there's no mistaking, there's no missing his power. He is powerful. Verse 4, he summons the heavens above and the earth that he may judge his people. He's given an invitation. He's given a summons to a trial. And you and I are the defendants. And it says that he summons the heavens above. The angelic beings are the witnesses. There's a jury, and court is being convened. And he says in verse 5, gather to me my consecrated ones who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. Now, these are the people that made a covenant with God, that God made a covenant with him. And one of the things they were to do is they were to make sacrifices. They were to take a lamb or a bull from their flock, one that didn't have any blemishes on it. And they were to take that animal after, I guess, raising it for a year and grain feeding it and grooming it and making sure that nothing happened to it. You know, you develop an attachment for animals. Even dumb cows. You know, my wife's aunt and uncle were farmers, and they would call their cows by name, number one, number two, number three, and those cows would respond to that. You know, and even dumb cows, you know, you work with them for a while and you develop an attachment to them. Now, God's people were commanded to bring an animal that they had raised and take it, I guess, to the high priest, and they had set it on the altar. And the person who was bringing this animal was to place their hands on the animal's head and articulate and enumerate their sins. And the animal would be slain. And the person, I'm sure, would feel the lifeblood, the life energy, the waning of the struggle of the animal, and literally feel the life going out of the animal. So this was a strong and visceral reminder of the need for atonement. And these are the people that God had made a covenant with. He said, bring to me the people that I've made a covenant with, the people who covenant with me by sacrifice. Verse 6, and the heavens proclaim his righteousness, for God himself is judge. So the scene is set. God is here. The heavenly hosts are here. And we're called before him. And here are the charges. First of all, a warning to the godly, verse 7 through 15. Look at verse 7. Hear, O my people, and I will speak. O Israel, and I will testify against you. I am God, your God. God is saying, there's order in the court. Be quiet and listen. Verse 8. I do not rebuke you for your sacrifices or your burnt offerings, which are ever before me. You know, the people in those days imagined that God actually needed food. You know, if you go into pagan societies, they're always feeding their gods. When you go to Brazil and you go in the graveyards, they have the Day of the Saints, and they bring food and candles, and they put all this stuff on the graves for the spirits that died, as if they would need it. And this is kind of a common thread. If you look, if you're an anthropologist, you will probably confirm that this is a common thread, that people think that their gods are hungry, that if they just feed them enough, that they'll be happy with them. That one of my favorite comedy movies was Joe and the Volcano. And the movie culminates with this guy being thrown in the volcano, to make atonement to the gods, as if that would make them be happy, that if, as if they would be happy with one little guy thrown into a volcano. We aren't like that, are we? I never give thinking, now God's really going to be happy with me this week because I wrote a big check. Or, you know, I did this. Or I pinched it for Randy last week. God is really going to be happy with me. I went and fed the poor. I took a missionary to lunch. I know you all don't think that way, but sometimes I catch myself thinking, God is really going to be pleased with me because I have done this. Now, the psalmist here is making it perfectly clear, speaking for God, that God does not need our gifts. He's not hungry. And so we don't have to satisfy his cravings by feeding him. God doesn't rebuke them for what they did, for what they gave, because they did give. But look at verse 9. He says, and by the way, as I read this, I'm going to put the emphasis as if I were the psalmist. The inflections that I have learned in reading about this would go like this. This is God speaking. I have no need of a bull from your stall or goats from your pens, for every animal of the forest is mine, and the cattle on 1,000 hills. And I know every bird in the mountains, and the creatures of the field are mine. The commentators feel like there's a little bit of a play on words here. Like, as if people, when they brought their offering, said, I'm bringing this goat from my pen and from my stall. And so God is getting the last word here. Don't think that it's yours. It's kind of like at Christmas, dads. Now, you all can relate to this. When you had little kids, and they don't have a job of their own, and so you're seeing that they need to get some Christmas gifts, so what do? You get out your wallet, and you give Johnny $10 and say, now go get some Christmas, or 20, or 50, or 100, or whatever. But then on Christmas Day, you open the present, and you think, I paid for this. What's wrong with this picture? It's good that we do that because we teach our children giving. But you know, God does that with us. The gifts that we give him come from him to begin with. So God says, I don't need a bull from your stall or goats from your pen because it's mine to begin with. I own everything. In fact, I always think about this. You know, when I'm in trouble, when I have needs, I remind myself that if God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, if he knows that I need one of them, he can spare it. Now, that doesn't mean that I go out and steal some farmer's favorite bull, but it reminds me that he owns it all and he provides it for us and that my needs are met by him. So he says, I don't need that stuff. Look at verse 12. If I were hungry, I would not tell you. For the world is mine and all that is in it. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? You know, like I said, many of these people thought that they were actually doing God a favor, that they were nourishing him, that they were feeding him. Do we, point of application, do we sometimes, back in the back part of our mind, buy into a mindset that we are helping God out, that we're keeping the utilities on in heaven, that we're keeping the power going, that we're keeping the electric or the gate opener for the pearly gates going by what we put into the offering plate, or that if we weren't here, Ken and Lucy would have to come back home? Don't for a moment think that. Don't buy into that, because that's the mindset that pagans bought into. So then why do we give? Why do we give? Verse 14 says, sacrifice, thank offerings to God, fulfill your vows to the Most High. Giving comes from a heart attitude. And the people were told to sacrifice offerings, and these vows, they were concrete expressions of gratitude and dedication to the Most High. That's one of the other names of God, Elyon. And they were told to give these thank offerings. And the interesting thing about a thank offering was after you sacrificed and after the high priest cooked the meat, that you were to eat part of it there in the presence of God. So these offerings were intended to not only be a form of communication of gratitude back to God, but they were a form of communion with God. You know, we send our money away. We give, and the picture here of giving is involvement. Involvement of not only the act of giving, but the heart being involved in the process of worship, of giving myself to God, of giving sacrificially and receiving something deep and something that moves me and changes me. And that's the picture we see here. So God said, I don't want just a gift. I don't need it. I'm not hungry. I don't eat bulls. So then if that's the case, why do we give? Verse 15 says, and call on me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you. You know, the times when I am moved to thankfulness, the times when I am deeply moved to give of myself to God, are often times when things have been tough, and I've been frightened, and I've not known what to do. Or last week, as we talked about, being between a rock and a hard place. And amazing thing, I've gone to God. It's kind of like when you don't know what to do, when you can't put the bicycle together and you've tried everything and you finally get out the instructions. I go to God helpless, and He somehow makes things right. And what occurs then is worship and thanksgiving. I'm thankful. I've been rescued. And the psalmist is saying here, call on me in the day of trouble and I will deliver you. So God, first of all, doesn't need the offerings of the righteous, of His people. He doesn't need those offerings. Secondly, He doesn't want the offerings of pagans. He doesn't want the offerings of people who do not follow Him. A warning to the wicked, verse 16 through 21. Verse 16 says, but to the wicked, God says, what right do you have to recite my laws or take my covenants on your lips? Wicked means twisted. He's saying, how can you even think about saying holy things? Verse 17 says, you hate my instruction and cast my words behind you. Folks, these are people that show contempt for God. This idea of you hate my instructions and you cast my words behind you. When you're driving down the road, do people ever throw money out the window? Or nice, if they've stolen it, they might, you know, and the police are after them. But normally, what is it that people throw out the window? Cigarette butts, Taco Bell wrappers, empty Coke cups, disposable stuff. You know, I don't do that. It makes me mad when people do that. But people throw trash out the window. They toss it. They're headed down the road of life, and they just toss it out the window. And the picture here is the wicked are those who take the word of God, take God's statutes, and they just toss them over their shoulder. I have no need for you, God. God says, I don't have any desire, I don't want their sacrifices. So the first thing we see that He says to the wicked is that they hate His laws and they refuse to even take into account. They treat them like trash. They show contempt for Him. Verse 18, it says, when you see a thief, you join with him. You throw your lot with adulterers. He's saying, when you see somebody climbing into a window of your neighbor's house, instead of calling 911, you walk over and say, fella, can I help you carry that 35-inch TV to your car? That's what he's saying. He's saying they not only are callous to wickedness, but they participate in it. Verse 19, you use your mouth for evil and harness your tongue for deceit. You speak continually against your brother and slander your own mother's son. They're disobedient. They have disregard for another's property, wife, family name, and honesty. God is saying, I'm holding court, and I want my people to know the proper reason for giving. But he's saying to those who don't follow him, I want you to know that I don't want to have anything to do with your giving. I don't want anything of it. Verse 21, he says, these things you have done, and I kept silent. You thought I was altogether like you, but I will rebuke you and accuse you to your face. How often, because God is silent, because God doesn't strike people dead with a lightning bolt, do we make the assumption that maybe he doesn't care, or maybe he's not powerful enough? How often do we look at what goes on in our government on both sides of the aisle, and we know that wickedness is afoot, and we know that people are doing wrong, and we think, well, God, aren't you going to strike them dead? You know, the psalmist said that too. He said, how long are you going to wait, God? Aren't you going to wake up and do something about this? Just because God is silent now doesn't mean he's sleeping. Just because God has not dealt with people who flagrantly and publicly commit immorality, who flagrantly thumb their nose at God, do not suppose for one minute that God is sleeping or he's off in Tahiti on vacation. God is saying here, just because I'm silent, don't think it's a tacit approval of what you're doing. Verse 22, he says, consider this, you who forget God, or I will tear you to pieces with none to rescue. Folks, God is patient. And even though his people struggle and get muddy and get up and continue to seek him, God is patient. And I've seen the patience of God in my life. There are times that I think back and I shudder. I'm embarrassed to even think that those things came out of my lips. And I think God is patient with me. But make no mistake about it, that God will judge people. He will balance the scales. The reason why he says vengeance is mine is because someday he is going to exact judgment, and his judgment is going to be great. And so in this next verse, verse 22, he says, consider this, you who forget God, or I will tear you to pieces with none to rescue. The people that thumb their nose at God, that have nothing to do with him, that violate his laws flagrantly, have their day coming. Finally, and this is where I want to be in this psalm, in this final verse, because this is the, you know, some text you have points as you go along, but in this psalm, the first 22 verses are setting you up for the last verse. God has convened a court, and he said, I don't need your gifts. You need to be giving to me, but I don't need them. And I'm not up in heaven wringing my hands saying, oh, I sure do hope that you all will give your money in the offering plate this week. Oh, I sure hope that you'll support missions. Oh, it just is going to just, the angels are going to starve to death if you all don't support the work of the Lord. The whole point of the psalm is to teach the mystery and the importance and the health for us in thanksgiving. And it's all right here in this last verse. And the reason why I've selected the NIV is because everything I've read, this interpretation more clearly presents this than any other. If God doesn't need our offerings, and if He doesn't want them from pagans, then why do we give? Look at verse 23. He who sacrifices thank offerings honors me, and he prepares the way so that I may show him the salvation of God. If God doesn't need our money, then why do we give to God? Follow me on this. If you're over on the golf course thinking about nine holes or whatever they do on golf courses, come back and stick with me for just a little while longer. When we understand that God is omnipotent, when we understand that He will not tolerate sin, even if for the moment He's silent, when we understand that the one God, the Creator God, the Redeemer God, provided atonement for us, when we understand that He gave the most precious thing that belonged to Him to bring about that atonement, hold that thought. I can't imagine taking my son up on a mountain with firewood and having him say, "Daddy, where's the sacrifice?" Well, God's going to provide it, knowing full well what I was getting ready to do. I can't imagine my sons on a cross because I sent them there. That goes beyond my ability to comprehend. When I think about that, I can't think about it. It's like I have to just put on the brakes and close my eyes and pull up in a fetal position because I can't bear to think of sacrificing someone that I love that much. And yet God did that. When we understand these things, then what flows from us is gratitude. For all you have done, I will thank you. For all you are going to do, for all you have promised and all you have done. And my word, I forget, but I love that song. Thank you. Thank you for loving. That it's a chorus that we sing. And those words should come spontaneously when we look at the cross and look at what He did for us. Then thanksgiving is not, "Oh God, I'm going to help you out because you're poor." Thanksgiving is not, "God expects 10% of the paycheck right off the top." Thanksgiving is not, "Well, the pastor told me to do this, or Randy told me to do this, or Ben said that if we don't cough up an extra 10%, we're going to go under." We don't give for those reasons. We give just as when we take a breath in, if we hold it forever, we turn purple. We have to exhale. Thanksgiving, giving out of a thankful heart, is part of what we do in the body of Jesus Christ. When we belong to God and we take in the fact that He redeemed us and He purchased us with the life of His Son, then the only thing we can do is exhale thankfulness. It's the only thing that I can logically do, because His actions defy logic. And something mystical happens. When I give, thankfully, sacrificially to God, when I give to Him in a way, and I'm not telling you give till it hurts, but when I give sacrificially, I begin in a small way to understand the sacrifice that He gave when He sent His Son to the cross. And that's what verse 23 says. Look at it one more time. He who sacrifices thank offerings honors me, and He prepares the way so that I may show him the salvation of God. I love that word salvation that you see in Psalms. Every time you see that word, highlight it in yellow and write below it, Yeshua, Y'SHUA. And that's the word for Joshua. And Mary named her son Joshua, or Jesus. The man that sacrifices thank offerings honors me, and he prepares the way so that I may show him the Yeshua, the salvation, the Jesus of God. As we give sacrificially, it brings the picture into focus a little clearer of what God did for us on the cross. We empathize with God. This is why today, don't bank on winning the Publisher's Clearinghouse. If you do, call me, because I'll help you spend it. This is why when I say, oh God, just let me inherit some money and I'll take care of the church. You know, if God knew that winning the Publisher's Clearinghouse would make me love him more, I'd win it. But I don't think it will. I think it would bring more problems than good. This is why God asks of us to give back to him. Because he made us, he knows how we're made, and he knows that in giving back to him, something healthy occurs. And it improves our spiritual vision. God is mighty. God is awesome. God is righteous. When we approach him humbly and sacrificially and give sacrificially of ourselves, he reveals himself to us in a deeper way. You know, it would be easy for me to recipe theology you. That means if you do this, 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 and this, then you'll be happy. And you'll never have a bad... That's kind of Prozac religion, you know? If you do all these things, then your life will be great. Your kids will not be ugly. Their teeth will be straight. And they'll wait till they're 28 to get married. And then 10 years later, they'll have children. And everything will go well for you. That's recipe theology. And so it'd be easy for me to say, now, if you just do this, everything's going to go well for you. That's not the case. God is bigger than us. But if you go out of here this morning, I want you to go with one thing. And that's, as we give from a heart of gratitude, God increases our understanding of the wonder of redemption. God gives us a deeper sense for what it means to give his only begotten son. And if you walk away from here saying, my God, you did so much for me. Salvation is bigger than I thought. If it leads you to worship, then this psalm has connected with your heart. Let's close in prayer. Father God, how often have we given to you thinking that we're earning brownie points? Father, how often have we approached you thinking that you need our giving? Father, how often have we thought that we're doing you a favor when all the time in your patience you have brought things into our lives to help us to understand that you loved us so much that you gave the thing that is most precious to you. And by giving back to you sacrificially, you enable us to understand how great you are and what a wonderful thing our redemption is. Thank you for this. In Jesus' name, amen.